Welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. The topic for today is information literacy and the changing nature of libraries. Joining Jeff Frederick, the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, are colleagues from the Mary Livermore Library. With them are Dennis Swanson, Dean of Library Services, Robert Arndt, Reference and Instructional Services Librarian, Roger Cross, Collection Development and Serials Librarian, and David Young, Catalog Librarian. Get ready for 30 Brave Minutes.
All across the world, information has never been so readily available. In 2002, the amount of digital information surpassed analog information, and the gap continues to widen every day. In part, information is growing because the world has more content creators, content archivists, and content consumers than ever before. In part, the amount of information is growing because our capacity to store and retrieve bits and bytes is growing exponentially. Cisco says the totality of the internet is worth some $19 trillion. Google processes 20 petabytes of data every day while executing 3+ billion searches per day and over a trillion per year, including one where I learned what a petabyte is. So what do we do with all this information, and how and who can help filter this for more uses than just who defeated whom in the NCAA tournament and therefore reduce my bracket to absolute insignificance? The American Library Association defines information literacy as, quote, a set of abilities requiring individuals to recognize when information is needed and have the ability to locate, evaluate, and use effectively the needed information. Information literacy is also increasingly important in the contemporary environment of rapid technological change and proliferating information resources. Sounds like a website definition. Well, I'm grateful to the ALA for that definition, but the definition and the note about proliferating information resources seems like a colossal understatement. Data is growing faster than ever before, and by the year 2020, about 1.7 megabytes of new information will be created every second for every human being on the planet. By then, our accumulated digital universe of data will grow from 4.4 zettabytes, which dwarfs a petabyte, by the way, if you've never heard of either, to around 44 zettabytes, or about 44 trillion gigabytes. Information, in other words, is everywhere and growing at an unstoppable rate previously only imagined in one of those sketchy science fiction movies that play in the middle of the night. In the midst of all this growth, have we lost our sense of value for the process of acquiring and sorting and sifting and analyzing and deploying information? Case in point, Alexa, Siri, or any number of data-assisted devices have reduced the search for answers to a simple audible query, rendering the knowledge of how to get the answer so 20th century. This is exactly why we need information literacy expertise, as the old-school traditional means to get the answer may ultimately be as important as the answer itself. In effect, the modern world has become a series of databases from which one, with the skilled assistance of a librarian, for example, can shorten the time of previously reading multiple bound books and journal articles. Those information sources were acquired through prolonged standing and sitting in the stacks. 100 years ago, libraries gained great acclaim for their prodigious facilities, for their card catalogs and the long rows of stacks, which might be evaluated as much on quantity as in quality. The New York Public Library, according to a 2015 New York Times article, has 2.5 million books, which of course seems a lot, like a lot, and admittedly, the New York Public Library has often produced different figures for the amount of books that they actually have. Case in point again, a 1905 article indicated the collection numbered 3 million. So in 100+ years, they lost 500,000 volumes? All of this is important for understanding a broader and more important point. Information is changing. That same massive public library and den of the two massive giant lions that guard its front entrance also has 45 million total research resources, many of whom are digital. So the library of the future will undoubtedly be moving to a place where lots of types of information can be accessed in an area where collaboration, teams, or groups of people deciding what is important or maybe what to do with the information take center stage. As others have noted, a library without books once seemed unthinkable. Now perhaps it seems inevitable. Our topic for today, information literacy and the changing nature of libraries. Joining us are Robert Arndt, Roger Cross, Dennis Swanson, and David Young. David, talk about the revolution in the way research is being done now as opposed to the way it was done maybe just 10 years ago.
Sure. I find that millennials compared to when we're growing up may be technologically savvy, but not research savvy. They don't know, like we would know automatically what a research paper was. We'd have to type it. Nowadays, they come up to the desk, often lost, and need our help to steer them in the way to use the resources effectively. So, for instance, I could use a case in point where the students, it seems to be a trend where rather than just writing something down on a piece of paper to find a book in our catalog, they bring up their smartphones to the reference desk and actually say, can you find this book for me? And I usually ask them, can you possibly enlarge that image because I can't possibly see it on your smartphone. So that's just a growing trend that I find in my experience on the reference desk, how library research has changed from what it used to be.
So some consumers of the library know how to get the number that they need to find, but they're not necessarily sure about where to go find where that volume and that number is.
That's correct.
Robert, what about you?
Finding information is sometimes difficult for them because they're so used to using Google and the web to do a search. They can just type the information in and find it. Library systems are a little bit more unforgiving. You have to know, search a particular database or database family to find your information. Some of it may be available full text in that database and some of it not. If it's not full text there, they may want give up on it or not look for it, whereas it may be available in a different database. They just don't want to take the time or the effort to find it, which makes it more difficult for them to find information. Or if it's not available electronically, they may not care. Or if it's not available even in print, some people say, well, I got to have a book. Well, it's the same information may be available electronically, but they just don't want to use it. They don't want to take the time. Or in our area, maybe they don't have the technological resources to study, to use it after they get off campus. So that became an issue. Becomes an issue.
Do you think the different faculty and community members and students who access this information, do you think they read a lot of stuff that they get their hands on and say, well, I read that and it's useful, but it doesn't really help me solve the research question I'm doing? It seems like in the old days we were all sort of lugging home 25 books, sorting through them one at a time, using those indexes by process of elimination, figuring out what works or not. Do we still grind through all of that information to really fine-tune what we're looking for?
Sometimes I think they take first available source and use it. I think when we had to grind through that information, we were processing a lot of it and doing a process of synthesis and coming up and comparing it that way. Instead of now, they just got the raw data and they're just looking for their answer. Mm. We've had people come in looking for topics in journal articles, and if their topic's not in that title of the journal, they ignore it. And we tell them, no, you actually have to read the articles, go through it. So it's the same process as 20 years ago. How they access it has changed, but they're wanting it also to be like Google and spot on, find what I need. I don't want to have to read the whole thing. I want to read my paragraph, my section, and not everything. So that loses part of the learning process in certain ways about synthesizing that information or at least seeing it or at least accessing and dealing with it.
Now, there's a sense in which the instant gratification model of the culture has gotten into research. They want answers and not process. They want things without work sometimes. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not like the libraries need to cater and just provide, here's a list of answers. we do need to inform and instruct. How do you go through the process? How do you get from A to B? How do you evaluate what you're looking at? It's an interesting phenomena that for years and years in colleges, universities, I did, maybe some of you did too. We had to take those classes as freshmen, how to use the library, how to research, how to do all of that. About 25, 30 years ago, that became a passé kind of model. They wanted to integrate everything into the classroom, let the professor guide his class or her class through the process. They called it embedded research. Probably in the last 5 years, all of the studies have indicated that model now is failing and failing badly. And we're kind of making a full circle back to information literacy again, because it's a whole new kind of data to be literate about.
And I think in some ways, some students come in, they haven't really thought about what they need yet. They know what they need, but they haven't thought about the keywords they need to find it. Whereas if you were using an old card catalog, you knew it was going to be hard. You knew you sort of had to look for specific terms to find your information. Students today sometimes have not made that step before they come. They'll come in and say, I need a book on history. You see the issue with that. There's billions of years of it, and you have to walk them through the process to narrow it down to what they really need.
Roger, so sometimes that's an issue. What do you think?
I suppose I'm going to take a dissenting opinion here. It is true that today we have instant gratification and people will want exactly the thing they're looking for and they get discouraged. But I remember doing research papers, and often what I was working on or wanted to work on ended up becoming directed by what of sources were available to me. And I didn't have a huge catalog of books or whatever, and I'd end up evolving my topic to fit my resources. Today, now we have peer-reviewed journal articles. Our library carries over 355,000 peer-reviewed journal articles.
And you haven't had to count those?
I have that. I've had to put them into database sheets.
No doubt.
We have all these scholarly works that now people have come to more or less expect that if they're looking for a topic, they're going to find answers. Now, it is true as a young, people coming into the university, especially in the early years, are not used to doing real research. But I think that once you get past a certain stage, upperclassmen, for example, you have a better sense of how to do research and how to locate those things that you're searching for.
So once a community member, a scholar, a student starts spending time with a librarian who can maybe help them develop those research capabilities, the huge amount of information and resources actually makes for a richer project. It makes for a better understanding in a lot of ways. But there is a different – the learning curve comes differently now, right?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean the thing now that happens, I mean even 10 years ago, if you were doing a doctoral program or doing a dissertation or doing some sort of research, you might have to buy plane tickets to get to whatever library actually physically held that commodity, and they weren't going to share it with you. You had to come to them. All of that's changed now. I mean, there's no there are very few barriers. The only barrier is, has this item been digitized yet? And we're moving towards a process where it's not a question of if something is going to be digitized and made completely available. It's just a matter of when. Google started that with Google Books, maybe a little bit more of a process than they thought it was going to be, but that's moving forward. Eventually, everything will be available to anybody, provided they pay the price.
I also found a growing trend with non-traditional students coming back that may have gone off to the military. I know because I've helped a couple recently like that. They said everything changed. Everything changed. So I went away in 1994, and I come back, and everything has changed in the library. So in a sense, I understand, because technology keeps changing. So I've had several of those episodes in recent months where you have to be really, really patient because, again, I think Robert was alluding to the fact that students have a question, they just don't know how to formulate it. They come up, they're lost. But that's what my job is to steer them to use to evaluate the resources effectively, the databases, and I've started doing more two-way learning because I found that when I first started, say, 18 years ago, which was last month, 18 years ago for me, I found I was almost spoon-feeding them. I hate to admit that, but yes, giving them the information, they weren't really learning. So in recent months, I've started to say, now, this is a different topic for you. What was the first step in this database? And I find that they really pick that up in terms of that it's really an effective technique to evaluate the databases, especially if they have multiple topics that they're dealing with. Because I don't know about my colleagues, but I'm sure they've probably had students coming up with multiple research topics, two papers.
Sometimes that happens. Sometimes students, as they do the research, as we talk to them and find resources for them, their topics will evolve because of the questions we ask. Because one of the things librarians' knowledge they have is a knowledge of the academic process of what makes a good paper, and we can pretty much judge sometimes if a topic is too broad and ask them that next step to go ahead and have them narrow down a topic or to better define it so that hopefully it'll meet their professor's research expectation instead of a broad topic that can be answered maybe by an encyclopedia article, which we try to get them down to that. Also, we've seen that a lot of older students who do return, they're amazed at how much information we can find very quickly instead of, you know, they remember the old card catalogs, maybe even paper indexes, the dinosaurs, using those and, like Roger said earlier, only having access to what they had in the library. Now we can get information from all over the world via interlibrary loan. Even articles we do not have full text access to, typically if it's an article within 2 or 3 days, we may have access for you for that article. But you have to make the step to make that request. You still have to make those steps to find that research and not settle for that instant gratification.
So the good old-fashioned value of initiative and, you know, learning to think intuitively about a research process is critical.
We'll return to our panel in 30 brief minutes in just a moment. UNCP and the College of Arts and Sciences are changing lives through education. To learn more about the college's 16 departments, college highlights, and news, as well as to find past episodes of 30 Brave Minutes and our digital journal Bravery, explore our website. You can also support our academic programs by clicking on the donate button. Additional news and events may be found by following us on Facebook at UNCP College of Arts and Sciences. Remember, wherever you go and whatever you plan to do, you can get there from here.
Let's segue in a slightly different direction. Because there's so much information available, how do you coach people up on how to gauge the accuracy or the veracity of all of this information that's at our fingertips? How do you teach people to know what information is valuable and what information is not?
We try to start them in peer-reviewed journal articles, to start them with that, especially for their research. And we'll ask them, do your professors require this? Some of them will have to pause and think about it for a minute, then say yes or say, I'm not sure, they never said. So, you know, we start with the students trying to get them to figure out what their professors need or what their research projects need, and we direct them to those resources to try to get them to think about it like that. And they may say, well, I can use this, and we'll try to tell them, well, that's not coming from an expert. To find expert articles, you need to look and see that they're written by experts to be sure they're in a well-known, a known journal in the field. We direct them towards information like that.
I go through an exercise sometimes when I'm teaching a class, and I'll put Wikipedia up on the screen, and I'm a Wikipedia editor, and I'll pull up an article on Winston Churchill, for instance, and I'll go in and they'll say, here's the information about Winston Churchill, and then I'll go in as an editor and I'll change his birthday and click the button. And I tell the people in the class, now look on your computer, look up Winston Churchill and whose birthday. Well, it's, as far as anyone knows, it's what I just typed in, and they would have no way of knowing that. And I use that as an example of saying you need to dig behind this information. You have to understand that you cannot take certain things at face value. You have to, you know, you can't distrust all information. I think that's part of some of the things today about fake news and things like that. So as though nothing is trustworthy, but at the same time, you just can't naively accept everything at face value.
Well, and we've all become curators of our own information, right? We'll take 7 pictures and pick the one we like the best and get rid of the 6 that we don't like as much. We'll, you know, check and double check our information before we'll send it out to a wider audience to make sure it presents us in the best possible information. I think on the other side, sort of following up with what Roger says, I mean, we don't want to necessarily presume that just because something was written in 1940 and it was in a book, it's necessarily accurate either. There are all sorts of ways. Information is just a source, and accuracy can be better or worse no matter how it's presented.
That's true. You have to look for multiple ways. I find that sometimes as students, there's so much information out there that sometimes they get confused even between a journal, distinguishing between a journal article and a book. And I'm sure my colleagues have had the same experience where you have to, say you're with somebody at the reference desk, show them the clues that they need to be able to distinguish between what is an actual and reliable journal article versus, say, the average book that you, or article that you get out of the normal, like Time magazine or Popular, to distinguish those sources.
And sometimes students don't look at the dates of material. They'll quote something from 1992 and give facts and figures from that. And if I'm reading that paper, I adjunct an English composition class, I'll say, why are you pulling this information that's 20 years old? They won't think about it like that. They see that information as what it is. It fits their point, and they don't go looking for that, a better source, right, a more primary source, so they stop there. Oh, I've got this source. It counts. It's good. Well, yeah. I'm going from there.
And teaching people, you know, the points of views of the people who are creating the information. I remember one student in a history class quoted General Cornwallis's biography on a particular battle in the American Revolution. Well, his viewpoint was obviously considerably different than Nathaniel Green's viewpoint on the same battle. And where, you know, but the student took, you know, that view as fact and the way it exactly happened, and it must be true because it's in a book. And it's just a matter of not only educating students, and sometimes it's a matter of educating faculty. We have educating faculty, what are these sources that are now available? How do we get it? We've had experiences where students are coming in and their assignment is to go through a particular index or source, and which hasn't existed in several years. They don't print that anymore. It's not created.
And, you know, faculty, for their part, you know, add in sort of the rich set of skills about understanding perspective and context and bias and, you know, sources that might be partially true but not completely true, and sort of getting into the guts of it. Faculty live in the footnotes, right? And sometimes getting down deep into those weeds provides tremendous information literacy skills. Let's talk about how all this comes together. With all of this exponential growth of digital and data-based sources, what's the library going to look like in 10 years?
I recently went to a conference, and it was in my field. It's the major conference for my collection development area, and it's international. The keynote speakers, there were two of them, and the first person dealt with the question, what will the library look like? And the second person dealt with in 10 years, what will the librarians be like? And the answer that the keynote speaker gave to the first question was the library workers would be robots. And the second was the library would be basically run by AI. Now, this isn't science fiction. They weren't talking about theoretical. They were working on prototypes. This was already in the works.
In a room full of librarians, probably didn't get a standing ovation.
And we left thinking we might be the last generation of human librarians. That was the talk afterward, because in many, I can understand how as the AI increases, you're going to be able to accomplish a lot of the things that we do through tedious analysis, spreadsheets, whatever. They'll be able to do that instantaneously, an AI. And they will know, for example, well, these students are now searching for this kind of information. We need to get more books or journal articles on this topic. And AI can handle that immediately. For us, it's more of a process. So.
Right. I mean, the term now is library 4.0. That's what they're as a few years ago they were talking about web 4.0. Now it's also library 4.0. What's the library going to look like going forward? And it is. It's almost going back to its roots. I mean, originally, libraries were collaborative places where people came to work and to debate and to interact because there weren't a lot of printed resources. It was still tedious handwritten scrolls, and people would come together and interact with ideas and depart. And we're again, almost coming full circle where libraries are going to be that collaborative, learning-centered space where the information is available, but the people are available to interact with and talk and to help sharpen thinking and ideas more than sitting in a cubicle in quiet and, reading a book on what those answers are.
So the library will become not only a place where information can be accessed, but a place where information is deployed and put together in a sense of searching for meaning of it all. The skill of getting the information will become easier to get. The skill of what to do with the information will be a place where library, like a European salon of the Enlightenment era, where great ideas and great pieces of information are discussed. The library might be a place where people are brought together, but maybe not for the same reason they're brought together now.
Exactly. And you know, even in our library moving forward, a place where you can also get a decent meal. You know, those sorts of things are changing.
So as the value and the access of information changes, the way in which we consume it and the place in which we consume it at and then what we do with it will continue to change. Will this be as true of academic libraries like Livermore as it is of, say, public libraries in small or large communities?
I think it will probably be about the same. I think the academic library of the future will need to have spaces for collaboration. They'll need to have spaces where students can practice certain skills, maybe like presentations on smart boards and that type of thing, because a lot of, you know, most any education class out in the school district now has some kind of smart board. And this will be an opportunity, if the library has these type of presentations, rooms to practice that. Maybe even also to conduct the interviews online and to show that other that presentation to people who are maybe recruiting them for jobs as well that way. So I think the libraries will have that type. I think they also will have certain rooms. I think they will have quiet rooms. I think they will have certain rooms where people can escape the social noise and the social media noise that's with them all the time now, because it will become too much of a distraction and they'll want that place to concentrate. So I think, you know, it'll be a balance, I think, between that. There will still be rooms, I think, for that. It will never totally go away, I don't think, but I think there'll be also be rooms for collaboration.
And in a world where increasing amounts of collections are digitized, original research may be in the sense of taking different pieces of information and compiling them or putting them together in ways that they hadn't been put together before to answer questions that had not yet been previously answered.
Exactly. And, the difference between a university library and the community public library, or even a special library in a corporation or a hospital, a lot of it is just the material you'd collect. A public library is going to, for instance, buy a lot of the current bestsellers and have things available for people. A university library, that's not necessarily our task. We could prioritize it. Basically, the students are first, the faculty comes in second, and then kind of everybody else after that. The public library is going to be almost the reverse. It's going to be the everybody else. It's going to be the community. It's going to be the big picture. You could almost we used to call it the information chain. The community library, the public library, is almost the encyclopedia, and the university library is the monograph and the journal literature and the specialized material, whereas that special law library or hospital library is kind of a pinpoint, this is all we collect. So it's kind of what the individual library collects and makes available as part of their purpose.
Well, thanks for a fascinating discussion on how we consume information, how we access it, what we do with it, and what the library is going to look like. Every year we'll be making sure we're spending copious amounts of time in the Livermore Library so we can see these changes going on. Thanks to all of our experts today in a really rich discussion. And tune in next time for 30 Brave Minutes as we tackle another interesting and thoughtful subject.
Today's podcast was produced by Richard Gay and transcribed by Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, UNCP, and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of UNCP. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of UNCP or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves.
Good job, everybody.